AM, and you are listening to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, AM 1340 KOMY Watsonville, and www.ksco.com worldwide. My name's Aaron Bond, and I'm here with your Central Coast weather forecast for Saturday, July 31st, and it calls for morning low clouds and drizzle clearing back to the ocean by midday. Otherwise, sunny skies, highs in the 60s along the coast to mid-80s inland, and an afternoon sea breeze 10 to 20 miles per hour. For your Monterey Bay boaters forecast today, winds light and variable, becoming west 5 to 15 knots in the afternoon time with wind waves 3 feet or less, swell 2 to 6 feet every 8 seconds, and some patchy morning fog still burning off. Currently 61 degrees here at the station, and we take you now to the Saturday special with your special guest host, Charlie Friedman. Stay tuned.
Good morning, a brighter day is here. Good morning, may we bring you cheer.
We've got time, we've got tunes, we've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go, it's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Time, tunes, and temperature, the old opening. Today it's the opening for Charles Friedman with the Saturday special, and we're going to raise your temperature talking about the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals with Reed Cox out in Virginia. He's joining us by phone. We'll get to that after just a little delay here.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is in session.
Did you know the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified this week in 1896? The 14th Amendment, which states that no person can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law or deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal laws. And did you know that on this Saturday special with Charlie Friedman from 10 a.m. to noon, his guest will be Reed Allen Cox, who is the author of a recent study that demonstrates the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is still outside the mainstream and is the most reversed court in the land. The study supports the view that the Ninth Circuit Court is still out of step while debunking the idea that the Ninth Circuit's ridiculous reversal rate is due to its case size. That's this Saturday in the Saturday special from 10 a.m. to noon with your host, Charlie Friedman, on your courting disaster radio station, AM 1080 KSCO and AM 1340 KOMY.
And so let's get right to it. It's a little bit past 10 o'clock in the morning at KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY Watsonville. I'm Charlie Friedman, and for the next 53 minutes, we are going to be joined by Reed Allen Cox. And I'm going to put him up right now because I want to ask him a few questions about himself and to give us a little bit of introduction and so on. Reed, are you there?
I am.
And you're joining us from where in the state of Virginia?
I'm in Alexandria. I'm just outside Washington.
Alexandria, Virginia, in the Washington, D.C. suburbs.
Yes.
Excellent. Now, before we do anything else, of course, I'm sure most of the people who are listening, in fact, up until a few minutes ago, I myself, have not heard of you. So why don't we talk a little bit about yourself, your qualifications, and so on. You mentioned that you had recently completed a white paper on the Ninth Circuit Court, and what was the title of that, please?
Sure. It's called U.S. Supreme Court Remains Wary of Ninth Circuit Rulings. This is the second white paper that I've done in 2 years, looking at the reversal rates of the various federal courts when those decisions are reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, and what are your qualifications to make such a study and write such a such an analysis?
Well, I'm an attorney here in the Washington area. I'm actually an attorney specialized in constitutional law. I work for the Center for Individual Freedom. And I authored this white paper for its sister organization, the Center for Individual Freedom Foundation.
Are you the type of attorney who does mostly research, or do you actually argue cases in court?
I do both, actually.
Outstanding.
The Center for Individual Freedom is certainly interested in protecting the individual rights and individual liberties of United States citizens. As a result, we engage in litigation, both in the U.S. Supreme Court and elsewhere.
So you have a framed copy of the Tenth Amendment on your wall?
I don't have a framed copy of the 10th Amendment. I do have a pocket copy of the Constitution that is by me at all times on my desk. But I'm also interested, of course, in the courts and who is making the law from the bench.
Right.
And whether they should even be doing that. And so, as a result, besides my litigation, I'm also very active in evaluating how the courts are doing their decision-making, and for that matter, who is doing the decision-making. So we look at the judicial nomination and confirmation process as well.
Outstanding. I'm going to take 2 seconds here. This is a telephone-in show, so I'm hopefully, and actually I'm pretty sure, given our audience, that we will have some people call in and want to make comments or ask you questions. Those of you who do wish to join us on the program today can do so by dialing 479-1080, that is 479-1080, or 477-1340, 477-1340. If you have some material that you'd like to bring to our attention, you may fax it to us at 475-2967. Reed, in the course of the remarks you just made, you used a phrase, making the law from the bench. And I wanted to take just a couple of seconds to go into that with you, because it's one of the things that drives me crazy. You've heard of Bob Woodward, I'm sure.
Sure.
Bob Woodward, the reporter who works for the Washington Post and who was instrumental in breaking the Watergate story years ago, and has since then written a number of books, most of which are quite scholarly. You've read, I assume, The Brethren.
I have.
The Brethren, for those of you in the audience who haven't read it, is a book about the United States Supreme Court covering, what is it, about 8 or 9 terms after Mr. Berger became Chief Justice in 1969? One of these, the book is organized by term. Each year is a chapter. I believe it was in 1973 that the Roe v. Wade case was decided.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bob Woodward, who wrote this book, is pro-choice. I am pro-choice. But as I read this chapter, it is so obvious, and Woodward makes no attempt to disguise it or color it. He presents a very objective analysis of what went on at the court. Justice Blackmun, in concert with a couple of others, began with, okay, here are the facts of the case. This is what we want to decide. Now, how do we get there? And they proceeded to construct under this result a group of flotsam and jetsam. Mr. Cox, what's wrong with this picture?
Well, I mean, there are so many things that are wrong with this picture, but let me start from a basic premise with your listeners, and that is that we are a nation that is governed, supposedly, in the end, by the people. And to do that, the people enact or elect representatives to represent them in Washington, to represent them in their state legislatures, to represent them in their local city council. What's difficult, what's really problematic about judges basically deciding what the law is that no one elected them. And this really comes out in decisions like you explain in Roe v. Wade, or in any number of decisions I would point to in the Ninth Circuit, their decision declaring the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional, the words "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional.
That's another very good example.
When judges basically decide, here is where I want to go, and let's not let the law stand in the way, let's instead reach our decision first and figure out how we can mold the law or cite the specific evidence we need to cite to get there, they have basically taken from their perch on the bench, an unelected perch on the bench, and basically taken away our own power to make our own laws and instead instilled that in themselves. Oh. A perfect example is a specific judge on the Ninth Circuit, Judge Stephen Reinhardt, who over the past 10 years has been reversed by the Supreme Court 53 times. Just so your listeners can really grasp the magnitude of that number, the Supreme Court decides about 80 cases a year. So if you multiply 80 by 10, the past decade, you get 800.
Right.
He's been involved in 53 reversals in those about 800 cases. That means a single man is responsible for about 6 to 7% of the reversals of the Supreme Court over the past decade.
Right, and bear in mind, he's from the Ninth Circuit. How many circuits are there altogether? 12?
There are 11 numbered circuits and then two that aren't numbered. They're called the D.C. Circuit and the Federal Circuit. So there's actually 13.
13 different circuits. So out of this one circuit and this one judge comes that high a number of the reversals the Supreme Court has had to make in the past decade.
It does. And it really stems from what we were just talking about, basically the judges taking it upon themselves to make the law. Stephen Leinhardt has not been shy in saying that when he's looking at a case, his first instinct is not necessarily to look at the text of the Constitution. His first instinct isn't necessarily to even look at the intent of what the legislators meant. His first instinct is to look at what the social justice of the case is.
See, now, let's take a couple of seconds here, Reed, because the people who are listening to the program, most of them are not legal scholars. Most of them are probably, you know, just ordinary citizens. And a lot of people might not be entirely clear on what the proper role of a judge is. Think back to your basic civics, and you'll remember there's three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. Back in high school, they taught you the legislature makes the laws, the executive enforces the laws, and the judiciary, or the judges, interpret the laws. Interpret doesn't mean make laws. And when judges decide to make laws, they find new things in the Constitution that simply aren't there. Or they make a decision that the way things have been done for 100 years is wrong, and we've all been, the law is wrong and has to be thrown out. What they're doing is assuming the role of a legislature. We had a case. Do you recall that case? I think it was in Kansas City, where a judge actually imposed a tax from the bench.
Yeah, I'm not aware. That case doesn't ring a bell, but you know, there's been equally as offensive cases in Nevada and in Colorado. There have been state Supreme Court decisions where the state Supreme Court has twisted their own constitution. You know, where the legislature has basically enacted constitutional amendments saying that they aren't going to have certain taxes, and where the state Supreme Court has basically turned that language into constitutional nonsense by saying, oh, well, this tax doesn't fit that prohibition. In California, with the pledge decision, mm-hmm. you had not only the legislature, the Congress, which added the words under God, and in the debate explicitly said that they were adding the words under God as a historical reference, not as a religious reference,
mm-hmm.
and not as a way of imposing religion upon the people. But then you have the executive that's never had a problem with those words, and yet you still have two judges of the Ninth Circuit, just two, that say, oh, no, that means when you have the words under God in the Pledge of Allegiance, that means you're imposing prayer. Not just a religious, historical religious reference, but prayer upon students. Never mind the fact that you're pledging allegiance to the flag and to the country, not to God.
Right, exactly.
You have decisions in California out of the Ninth Circuit involving criminal defendant rights that have never been found before in the history of this country. You have decisions from California courts and from the Ninth Circuit with regard to California's three strikes you're out laws, where they said, you know, oh, it doesn't really mean that if you get any third offense, you get a high penalty. It only means if you get a third offense of some significance, you get a heavy jail sentence.
You know, right now,
legislators never said anything about.
Right now, here in California, we've seen some cases where people, that three strikes law is an interesting one, because there's a measure on the ballot, I believe, in November out here to modify the three strikes law. And I'd like to ask you about this, because I think they're going about it in the wrong way. When three strikes was originally approved, it was presented as, and it is written as, three felony offenses. Felony offenses, not misdemeanors.
Yes.
So the voter voting on this sees the word felony and decides, okay, felonies are serious offenses per se. And so they voted yes on this. And then we get these pieces in the paper about somebody, their third strike was shoplifting a loaf of bread, or their third strike was ripping off a video store for a couple of tapes or something of this nature. And all I can think of is, if those crimes are felonies, then what we need to do is address what we define as a felony and what we define as a misdemeanor. Leave the three strikes law alone.
Yes, the Supreme Court, you know, this is interesting because these were cases at the Supreme Court last term, last year, and the Supreme Court did uphold the free strikes law.
That's true, they did.
It upheld them even in the context of where the third offenses were things like shoplifting a golf club, shoplifting movies, and said, you know, that isn't cruel and unusual punishment, not disproportionate given prior offenses, etc. Now, the difficulty that I see with the three strikes law with regard to these decisions is that the law is actually written quite plainly and defines what type of offenses qualify for the third strike. When you have courts going back and basically saying, well, you know, if someone shoplifts a golf club, I'm not so sure that that should qualify as a third strike, they're basically totally rewriting the statute, because as long as that offense qualifies under the statute for the third strike, there should be no room for maneuvering. So I think you're absolutely right in the sense that if the problem is that third strike offenses like shoplifting and golf club are qualifying under the statute, then what should happen is not that a federal judge or a state judge should be deciding case by case whether that seems all right to them, but rather what should happen is that the legislator should be taking care of that by defining those offenses properly.
We're going to take a quick break here right now. Thank you very much for that, Reed, and we'll be back with Reed Cox in a couple of moments. We also have our first caller on the line. If you'd like to be our second caller, you can dial in during the break at 479-1080. I'm Charles Friedman, this is KSCO, and you're listening to the Saturday Special.
Ladies, how would you like to be a member of a family-run business? How would you like to belong to a health club that focuses on you in a warm and friendly atmosphere? Well, I'm Teresa, and I'm the owner of Go Figure Fitness for Women in downtown Santa Cruz. Go Figure is not a franchise or tied into one. We're the small fish in the big sea. Our members are number one to us, and we'll take great care of you. Go Figure is an all-women's health club that focuses on the whole woman, including your nutritional needs. A membership at GoFigure includes one-on-one personal training, weight loss and nutrition counseling, along with the ever-so-popular 30-minute circuit with no hidden fees. GoFigure carries the complete line of the American Longevity products. So come join a club that takes care of the whole woman and is member-friendly. GoFigure, located in downtown Santa Cruz. Call 426-3948. Again, the number is 426-3948.
Hello, KSCO listeners, it's MZ. I have a special request. A very dear friend of mine has recently been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Sadly, one of the deadliest forms of cancer one can have. Luckily, the cancer is not in a very advanced stage, and my friend and his spouse have such positive attitudes that I believe that if anyone can beat the odds, it is this wonderful, special couple. Here's my request. Is there anyone in our KSCO audience who has had pancreatic cancer and beaten it, or knows of such a person, or who knows of any traditional or alternative cancer treatment centers anywhere that have had success specifically treating patients with pancreatic cancer? If you can help, please contact me by email to mz@ksco.com or simply call the KSCO comment line at 429-2222. That's mz@ksco.com or leave me a voicemail at 429-2222. I would really appreciate your help. Thank you.
How's this for a summer bargain? Travel 1,000 miles for less than $250, and that includes room and board for the entire family. Where can you find this bargain? RVs of Merritt in Scotts Valley. With over 4 acres of Winnebagos, Alphaseas, Dolphins, Bigfoots, and Weekend Warriors, RVs of Merritt has the perfect RV for you. And get this, RVs of Merritt has the new Winnebago Vista, the small class C motorhome built on a commercial VW truck chassis from Germany. With its powerful V6 engine, the Vista gets great gas mileage and sleeps 4 fully contained. Here's the best part. You can own a brand new Vista RV for less than car payments and get a second home tax deduction. RVs of Merit still has the fantastic 2.99 interest rates. So hurry in and lock a rate today, and you'll look like a hero in a year from now. RVing is the least expensive way to see the good old USA, and RVs of Merit in Scotts Valley is always the best way to RV, serving the Central Coast for over 30 years. RVs of Merit. 2.99% fixed for 10 years on selected 1999 or newer models. Customer participation required on approval of credit.
Now back to the Saturday special with special guest host Charlie Friedman.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Welcome back to the Saturday special. And our phone-in guest today, our phone-in expert, is Reed Cox. He's calling us back from Alexandria, Virginia, but we're talking about local issues here because this is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is headquartered in San Francisco and deals with the western United States. And we're talking about specifically, are they on the same wavelength as the rest of America or the rest of us? Because they get reversed an awful, awful lot. Reed, we seem to have attracted a caller. Would you like to talk with Jeff?
Sure.
Okay. Jeff, thank you very much for joining us on the Saturday special. Please go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
What I find interesting is this idea of separation of church and state came from a Supreme Court decision in 1878 called Reynolds versus United States, in which the court determined that it was the legislative branch of government that had the authority to regulate marriage by statute alone, that marriage is a statutory requirement, a licensing requirement by the legislative branch of government. And when we talk about this issue of gay marriage, I think it's very interesting that this is not part of the public dialogue.
Reed, do you have a response to that?
I certainly think that's an interesting point. I'm not sure that I myself would point to the licensing of marriage as the first cornerstone or the first stone laid in the ground in the separation of church and state. I guess I would point to there is, you know, a constitutional guarantee, obviously, in the First Amendment that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And there's been a number of Supreme Court decisions since then limiting or imposing when government should and should not get in religion, get involved in religion. But the one clear thing has been, I think the Ninth Circuit always recently, since 2002 when the decision came out, gets talked about with regard to the Pledge case. And that is that there's a very different view on the Ninth Circuit with regard to the role of religion in public life than there is in the rest of the country, including the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has approved historical and cultural references to religion, and in fact has gone so far as to say that can't get rid of religion from the history of the United States. In fact, you know, the High Court, the Supreme Court, of course, opens, and in fact the Ninth Circuit does as well, each of its sessions with an invocation from the marshal saying, God save this honorable court. But the Ninth Circuit, when it decided the Pledge case, went a very opposite direction. And in fact, what's really amazing about the case is the case really didn't have get much notice until the Ninth Circuit dealt with it, and in fact it's just declaring the words under God and the Pledge unconstitutional was really a creation of the Ninth Circuit's own. It was not as a result of necessarily good lawyering skills. The guy was suing pro se and in fact received such little notice the district court dismissed his case in opinion that stretched little more than a page.
Now you're speaking here about Michael Newdow
Yeah. So in other words, it wasn't Michael Newdow that really created the Pledge case or created the whole fury over whether under God should be in the Pledge. Rather, it was two judges in the Ninth Circuit who reached out to a case that was supposed to basically get no notice at all and used the case as a vehicle for basically imposing their views that they think the wall of separation between church and state should be so high that no religious reference ever allowed in the public sphere.
What I found interesting, though, the original language, separation of church and state, arose out of the 1878 Reynolds case concerning the regulation of marriage, the licensing of marriage, and that it has gone on from there. That was the original, that's the original precedent that was set by the Supreme Court concerning that language, separation of church and state. And I find it very interesting that today we construe that to mean just about anything that somebody decides on the bench instead of relying upon the original precedent set by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really good point that the caller makes. I think that the one of the points that's really dangerous about judging, and it was a point that I tried to make earlier, and that is that language is malleable, and so you can take these cute, easily described concepts like separation of church and state, and that may mean 100 different things to 100 different people. And for the Ninth Circuit, it means an impenetrable barrier. And so it really shows that, this can't be government or governing by soundbite. I mean, separation of church and state might mean something, but it means really something totally different. There wasn't a whole lot of the case that the caller is pointing to back in the late 1800s. That was not the whole idea. In fact, the First Amendment, for that matter, wasn't imposed upon the state until after the 14th Amendment, which did come before the decision your caller is pointing at, but really wasn't applied to the states until the 1900s, in the middle of the 20th century. So this is the importance of not doing just the sound bites, but also reading both the entire decisions and also making sure everyone understands the context of these decisions.
One other question before I go. Concerning
sure.
the Ten Commandments and the refusal to hear the Ten Commandments being posted in the Alabama Supreme Court
yes.
by the United States Supreme Court, who also has the Ten Commandments posted on their court.
Yes.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually I saw that former Chief Judge Moore, is now taking the Ten Commandments monument around the country basically a show of strength for the Ten Commandments. Religion is one of these areas of law that has really been not well done by the Supreme Court, and I'll admit that at the outset. The United States Supreme Court has never said equivocally that you cannot have the Ten Commandments in the courtroom, and in fact the courts are split on this issue. The problem with Chief Judge Moore and his Ten Commandments, and I think the reason the Supreme Court didn't take the case, is that Chief Judge Moore had really made it clear that the reason he wanted the Ten Commandments in the courtroom and in the special place in the courthouse, I should say the courthouse that it was at in Alabama, was for a religious reason. And that starts to look like you're imposing religion upon others. The line of distinction that the courts have made is that it's absolutely fine to have historical acknowledgments or cultural references to a shared common religious heritage, but it is not okay when this starts to look like the government imposing religion upon either non-believers or people that are undecided.
I just think it's very interesting that the basis of our laws are the Judaic culture and the Ten Commandments, but anyway.
And that's certainly true. And in fact, this is one of the things that I would point out to the listeners that's really problematic about the Pledge case. If the Pledge case is right, if the Ninth Circuit was right in the Pledge case, that we can't have any reference to God in our public sphere, then the very first place they have to start is with the Constitution. Because in Article 7, right before you have all the signers to the Constitution, it talks about that this Constitution is made in such and such a date, this year of our Lord. I mean, it's incredibly clear that the founders had a common religious heritage that you just simply cannot get rid of from our history.
Jeff, thanks for calling and sharing some points with us.
You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Why should you be able to light one by burning a flag?
Because it's political expression.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm probably about as conservative as most people, but I think Justice Scalia decided that one right. Burning a flag is political expression.
And if you have
but when you do it, I have every right to look at you and say, you burned the American flag? That means you're a congenital idiot, and I don't have to listen to anything else you have to say. You're saving me time.
If you get a permit from the local government for the fire ordinance to burn something in public, well, I guess it's okay then, isn't it?
also, you better not have stolen somebody else's flag. You better have doggone well bought your own. Otherwise, you're guilty of destroying stolen property.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right.
Have a good one. Jeff, and we'll probably have a couple more callers during the hour. I hope we do, 479-1080. You know, Reed, you were talking about the Ninth Circuit Court a few moments ago. I want to get back to that if we can. How many judges are there on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, please?
26 active judges, and in fact, you know, these courts never make it easy to discuss anything about them, but there are 26 active judges, and there are actually another almost, there are another 23 judges that the U.S. courts call senior judges, but really that means semi-retired, meaning that they don't have to take a full caseload.
Okay, I understand. Of those 26 regular positions, are all of them full at this time, or are there any vacancies?
Well, actually, the Ninth Circuit's allowed to have 28, so there are two vacancies right now.
Two vacancies.
There are currently only 26 active judges on the court. But what's interesting is who are those active judges?
Okay, go into that, would you?
14 of them are Clinton appointees. So more than half the court was appointed by President Clinton. There are only three judges appointed by George W. Bush, and then there are a couple judges appointed by Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., or the first President George Bush, and the rest of them are Carter appointees. The court is overwhelmingly a court that was appointed by Democratic presidents. And if you look at the judges that have been reversed, Judge Reinhardt is a Carter appointee. He was reversed over the past decade 53 times. Betty Fletcher and Harry Pregerson, both democratically appointed judges, were reversed 28 times apiece over the past decade. The Chief Judge, Mary Schroeder, was a Carter appointee. She sits in my hometown of Phoenix, Arizona. And Senior Judge William Canby also reversed about the same amount of times as Mary Schroeder in the 20s over the past decade, also a Carter appointee. It's a court that's very much unlike the rest of the country, especially given the fact that you had 8 years of the Reagan administration, another 4 years of the George H.W. Bush administration, and now George W. Bush. It's a court unlike any other in the country that's controlled by democratically appointed judges.
Just kind of a coincidence of when the vacancies happen to occur, I would presume.
Well, that's certainly
part of it. A president can't dictate vacancies on a court. Of course, FDR tried to back in 1938, but he got his ass kicked for that.
He did. And you know, that's actually a really good lesson. You know, earlier we were talking about how judges shouldn't make law. And one of the reasons we have such respect for judges is we think they're independent. And in fact, a perfect example of that is, as you point out, the court packing plan of FDR. You know, the country got up in arms when FDR, through a very thinly veiled threat, basically said, "I want to influence the which way the Supreme Court is going, and the way I'm going to do it is by packing the court."
At the risk of revealing myself as a frustrated history teacher, for those of you in the radio audience who are not familiar with FDR's court packing plan that Reed is talking about. Franklin Roosevelt had been president for about 6 years, and a number of his New Deal measures had been overturned by a more conservative Supreme Court. He was upset about this. In 1937, he looked at the Supreme Court. There's these nine judges. At that time, of the nine, six were over the age of 70 years. So FDR proposed that for every justice over 70 years of age, he get to make one additional appointment to the court, which would have yielded a Supreme Court of 15 members, six of whom would have been immediate FDR appointees. Now, it's interesting to note that during the Reagan administration, the court was fairly liberal, and six of the members were over 70 years of age. But I noticed that President Reagan never proposed that he be given an additional appointment. Now, this is something, in all fairness, FDR was simply smitten with his own importance at the time. This went to the Congress, which at that time was overwhelmingly Democratic, and even the Democrats in Congress would not swallow that court-packing plan. As a matter of fact, a lot of people after that came to look at FDR more and more as somebody who was, maybe just getting a little bit too comfortable in power.
Yeah, it bombs in public opinion. As I recall, my frustrated history lessons, he had actually went to the country with this idea, I believe in maybe even one of his fireside chats, and it just did not resonate.
It was a non-starter. Let's take a brief break here and get back with you. Tell the audio radiance out there that you are listening to the Saturday Special. I'm Charles Friedman. Our guest today is Reed Cox. He's calling from Virginia. We're talking about the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and judicial issues in general. During this break, if you'd like to go on the air with us or if you have a question or a comment, please call in at 479-1080 and we'll handle your call right after these messages.
Hello there, Broadband Dan from GateSpeed here. If you need fast internet connectivity and are fed up waiting for DSL or cable internet, call GateSpeed. We'll connect you fast. We are the creative wireless engineers. If you need to connect multiple offices for your business or set up a hot zone at your restaurant or office, GateSpeed is here to solve your problems. Call us at 408-747-1507, 408-747-1507, or on the net at www.gatespeed.com.
My name is Troy, and I met my fiancé on eHarmony.com.
My name is Tom, and I met my fiancé, Brenda, on eHarmony.com.
My name is Jack, and I met my wife, Jennifer, on eHarmony.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. These are just a few of the thousands of eHarmony matches. Dating services give you a picture in a paragraph. We go a lot deeper. We start with a personality profile that features 29 dimensions of compatibility, crucial to a long-term relationship. And if you go to eHarmony.com right now, we'll give you this $40 profile free. And then we'll find you a soulmate based on compatibility in the most important areas of life. Visit eHarmony.com today. Get your free personality profile.
Hi, my name's Daniel, and I found my fiance Allison at eHarmony.com.
A lot of happy couples out there tonight, thanks to eHarmony.com.
Hello, KSCO listeners, it's MZ. I have a special request. A very dear friend of mine has recently been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Sadly, one of the deadliest forms of cancer one can have. Luckily, the cancer is not in a very advanced stage, and my friend and his spouse have such positive attitudes that I believe that if anyone can beat the odds, it is this wonderful, special couple. Here's my request. Is there anyone in our KSCO audience who has had pancreatic cancer and beaten it, or knows of such a person, or who knows of any traditional or alternative cancer treatment centers anywhere that have had success specifically treating patients with pancreatic cancer? If you can help, please contact me by email to mz@ksco.com or simply call the KSCO comment line at 429-2222. That's mz@ksco.com or leave me a voicemail at 429-2222. I would really appreciate your help. Thank you.
And we're back on the Saturday Special. Charlie Friedman here with Reed Cox. Reed, you had been mentioning the specific reversal rates of some of these judges on the court, but rather than get into who's being reversed, let's take a few moments and talk about what's being reversed. I can't help but remember years ago, Barry Goldwater, he was giving a comedy speech at the time, but he proposed a legislation mandating that any decision of the Supreme Court must make sense.
I hadn't heard that before, but that's a good one.
And what I'd like to ask you to do, please, is to go into specifics about a couple of these reversals, perhaps, and explain just exactly what the case was, what the Ninth Circuit Court held, and why it was out in left field.
Sure. Well, let me start with some numbers first.
Please do.
I realize that we haven't talked about these.
Okay.
You know, we hear about the Ninth Circuit being the most reversed court, but it really is kind of shocking to see how many reversals there are. The Supreme Court, as I said earlier, takes about 80 cases a year. Specifically this past year, they decided 79 cases. Of those 79, more than 30% came from the Ninth Circuit. 25 of the cases they decided came from the Ninth Circuit. And in
why such a high number of cases that get to the Supreme Court from here? Because they need to be reversed?
Well, I think it's a combination of reasons. I mean, I think it's too simple to say they need to be reversed, although I will tell your listeners right off the bat that the Ninth Circuit was reversed in 19 of the 25 cases the Supreme Court took up this year. So
that's two-thirds or more.
So basically, every three out of four cases the Supreme Court takes to the Ninth Circuit, they were reversed.
Lord.
That's certainly one reason. And in fact, you know, the Supreme Court, unlike the president or unlike the Congress, can't come grab a judge by the hand and say, look, you're not doing your job. You need to do it differently. Instead, the Supreme Court, it's a very above-the-board type of organization and way of doing business. And so the only way that they can send instructions to the lower courts and to the lower court judges is by taking up cases that they've decided and reversing them and giving them basically instructions through these opinions.
Mm-hmm, right.
And one of the ways they do this, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether the Supreme Court is conservative or liberal, or which judges are conservative or liberal. But you know you have something really gone amiss when the Supreme Court, all nine justices, unanimously agree that what you did was wrong. And
so they're not only reversed, they're reversed on a 9-0 vote?
On a unanimous vote.
Oh, my
God. And of the 19 decisions that were reversed by the Ninth Circuit by the Supreme Court this last term from the Ninth Circuit, more than half, 10 of them, were unanimously reversed.
Gee whiz.
I'll
be honest. I was sitting here thinking, yeah, a bunch of 5-4 reversals, but you're saying no, Charles, no.
No, 10 of the 19 reversals were unanimous. All nine judges of the Supreme Court agreed. And in fact, that 10 number is probably undercounting, because I only count when they're unanimous, when every single justice of the Supreme Court not only agrees in the reversal, but agrees on the reason. So here we'll come to our first case. We'll come to the Pledge of Allegiance case.
Okay.
The Pledge of Allegiance case was reversed by the Supreme Court by an 8-0 vote. Justice Scalia did not participate. So all eight justices of the Supreme Court that sat and heard that case agreed the Ninth Circuit should be reversed.
Including all of the more liberal ones, because Scalia is a conservative.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Now, I didn't count that in the 10 number of unanimous reversals, because the justices didn't all agree that it should be reversed for the same reason.
Uh-huh.
Five of the justices, all the liberals plus Justice Kennedy, so you're talking now Justice Stevens, Justice Breyer,
Empty Souter.
Yep, Justice Souter, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Kennedy, said that the reason they had to reverse the Ninth Circuit is because it's really not appropriate for a federal court to get involved in a domestic custody matter. If your listeners may remember, I hate to digress too far.
Well,
but
it was a jurisdictional thing.
Yeah. Basically what happened was Michael Newdow is the father of a daughter he doesn't have custody over.
Right.
He brought this case challenging the pledge, saying, well, my daughter shouldn't have to say the pledge with the words under God. Well, the Supreme Court said, well, that's all fine and good, except for you're not the custodial parent, so it's kind of hard to understand why you should be the one bringing this suit as opposed to her mother. So the four liberal justices plus Justice Kennedy agreed with that notion. Basically said, look, we shouldn't be getting involved because this is a family law matter that shouldn't be handled by the federal courts. It should be handled by the state courts.
Right.
The other three justices all basically, Justice Rehnquist, Justice O'Connor, and Justice Thomas, all basically said, oh, never mind the family law issue. Yeah, you're probably right that federal courts shouldn't be dealing with that too much, but the constitutional issue is still important. We should decide it. And what they said, in essence, although they each said it in a different way, was that, look, a historical reference to under God is not the type of thing the Constitution prohibits.
No, not at all.
And in fact, this was no surprise, and in fact, we don't know, but we think, you know, most people think, that that's probably even the case for those five justices that got rid of it based on the custody issue. Because over the past four decades, if not more, 12 or more justices have said in various opinions of the Supreme Court that whether it's under God in the Pledge of Allegiance or in God we trust on our coinage and paper money, those aren't the type of references that are prohibited by the Constitution. In fact, we have decisions that are crystal clear where the court has said it's fine that Congress has a chaplain and that they open their sessions with a benediction and an invocation. These aren't the type of things that are, we don't take basically religion to the nth degree.
This is where the Michael Newdows of this world would like to go. I'm waiting for a suit that says, well, since every session of Congress since 1789 was the first Congress, has begun with an invocation, then every law ever passed by Congress is void.
Are
you ready for that?
I haven't seen that remedy, but you do know that Michael Newdow.
How about this one? Are you a veteran?
I am not myself.
Okay, I am a veteran, and I can tell you that in the United States Navy and in the other services, there are a group of commissioned officers known as the Chaplains Corps, and they are actually they're given congressional commissions. They are commissioned officers of our military, and their job is to be chaplains. And they are Roman Catholic chaplains, Lutheran, Protestant, Methodist. I met one Jewish chaplain out in the Western Pacific, and I asked him, "What are you doing out here?" And he says, "By golly, I am Com Jew Pack," which means Commander Jews in the Pacific. He was a wonderful fellow, but a name like Friedman, he loved me. Anyway, my point being, you have this group of people whose job it is to do the Lord's work among the American servicemen. Holy smoke! I'm surprised they haven't taken out after them with burning torches and shackles. But I'm waiting for that. I really am. Listen, we've got a caller. I'm going to get him up on the line here. Let's see if we can get one more issue handled today. This is Mark in Watsonville. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Charlie. Fascinating show. I got two related issues. I was watching Peter Jennings the other night, and he was interviewing John Kerry.
Now, why in hell's half acre would you be doing that?
Because you must, to be a critical thinker, you must look at things from both aspects.
Oh, all right.
Okay. He was interviewing John Kerry, and he brought up John Kerry's statement of in Iowa, when does exactly life begin? And John Kerry stated that life begins at conception. And Jennings asked him about that, and Kerry said he is going to follow the Supreme Court's definition of when life begins. And he stated that was given in Roe v. Wade. So I looked up Roe v. Wade, and Roe v. Wade affirms the 9th and 14th Amendments and deals quite a bit with privacy rights. But I never saw in there at any time when the definition of life beginning ever mentioned. So is our presidential candidate somewhat confused on the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I'm not sure if he's confused or if he's flip-flopping.
Okay. I think he's obfuscating.
I should say that, but your caller is actually right. Roe versus Wade and the cases that followed it don't say life begins at this point. Rather, what they say is that the woman has what they found was a privacy right, and that privacy right either outweighs the unborn child or does not outweigh the unborn child, depending on how it's developing. In other words, what trimester it's in.
Well, the reason I bring this up, there is going to be a case becoming before the Ninth District soon, and it's really interesting. A woman was deported back to Mexico. And she is pregnant, and she is stating that her fetus is a U.S. citizen, and it has gone to for review on a lower court. But she is stating, since her child was conceived in the United States, that her unborn child that she is carrying is a U.S. citizen, and since she is carrying it, she cannot be deported because you're deporting a U.S. citizen. And I think this will be fascinating in that it may contradict the abortion rights crowd, in that you can't have it both ways.
I think it's a fascinating case anyway, regardless of the abortion issue.
I hadn't heard about this one. I'm glad you brought it up.
I hadn't heard it either. And this is exactly the kind of case that will really, really, really go with the Ninth Circuit well, because the Ninth Circuit has been known to be very liberal on two issues, immigration issues and issues of criminality. And most likely, if the woman was deported, it's likely that she was deported not simply because she was an illegal alien, but that she was an illegal alien that was caught doing something criminal in the United States. Now, the law has been exceptionally clear on the immigration front that basically what happens is you don't become a U.S. citizen until you're born. So the fact that the child may have been conceived in the United States or was carried in the United States doesn't make it a U.S. citizen until it is actually born here in the United States. But, well, you know, given the Ninth Circuit's liberality, it wouldn't surprise me for them to try to basically do exactly as your caller is saying, try to stretch these definitions out.
To make a new United States citizen
where there wasn't one.
One other thing could mention about this, I don't know if it enters into the decision or not, but I know darn well that for a number of years now, women from Hong Kong in particular who become pregnant would make every effort in the world during their period of pregnancy to somehow get into the United States so that the baby could be born here. Not conceived here, mind you, but born here.
Sure, and there are big advantages, obviously, to having a child that is a United States citizen.
Oh, you betcha.
The easiest way is, of course, to have your child born in the United States.
Right.
And, of course, the main reason why it's a big advantage is because, for practical reasons alone, the United States government isn't inclined to say, oh, well, sure, your child is a United States citizen, but we can't have you in the country.
Right. It gets a bit impractical, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I'm really glad your caller brought this to my attention because it's a case I'd certainly like to check out for myself.
Mark, do you have any idea when this one's going to be argued and when we can look forward to hearing about it in the papers?
I believe it's ongoing right now because I actually read it in the papers, so it's an ongoing case.
Well, it's certainly fascinating, and I really think, you know, this is yet another case that you're kind of hearing it first on the air. This is another case that the listeners could watch to see what the Ninth Circuit does with.
Yeah, I'm going to have to keep my eyes peeled because I hadn't seen a thing about it yet.
The law is exceptionally clear in that this case should go nowhere. I mean, if the judges really interpret the law correctly, it's not a United States citizen until it's born here, and there's certainly no problem with deporting her. So
the case should be just ba-boom.
If the judges find you can have an unborn United States citizen, that will be really, really new law. And I would imagine the Supreme Court will take a look at that one as well.
I think the 14th Amendment has been historically twisted for this being born in the United States where you're automatically a U.S. citizen. I mean, the 14th Amendment was so that ex-slaves would be granted immediate citizenship in that they are already here, and somehow it's been convoluted that if you are illegally in the United States but have a child, all of a sudden that child is automatically a citizen of the United States, which to me is nonsense. In that, does that mean that any ambassadors or ambassador staff from some foreign country, any of them having a child here in the United States, those childs are automatically citizens? I mean, this is such a bizarre interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Well, and you know, the caller is I actually don't think that the interpretation is so bizarre. I guess the kind of way I think about it is, if you're born here, even if you're not here legally, well, where else would you be a citizen? I guess the answer would be from the country that they're illegally left. But the 14th Amendment has been the grounds of all kinds of things. The 14th Amendment was, of course, the grounds, as your caller noted, of the Roe v. Wade decision. It's been the grounds of last year's overturning of sodomy laws. It's been the grounds of decisions about all kinds of various privacy, including sexual privacy. And really, it was intended originally to be, as the caller notes, an equal protection provision. In other words, that all the races should be treated equally before the law and there should be no special rules. And in fact, as we saw last term in the Supreme Court, even that has started to turn out differently because the Supreme Court did not totally get rid of affirmative action programs based on race.
And, of course, we should notice that it wasn't too long after the adoption of the 14th Amendment that, it was the Republican Party deciding that they bargained away, essentially, the 14th Amendment for the 1876 presidential election. And after that, you saw the Jim Crow laws and et cetera come in, and the 14th Amendment's equal protections were a complete dead letter until they were resuscitated many years later by Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I really believe that one of the advantages, and it's certainly still not perfect. But
Reed, we've only got a few seconds left, so make it quick.
I think one of the big differences between the U.S. Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit is how they read. And the U.S. Supreme Court reads the Constitution with a common sense eye, and the and the Ninth Circuit too often doesn't, and I think that really explains why they remain the most reverse court.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your taking your time to be our guest here. This is Reed Cox you've been listening to, ladies and gentlemen. He's with, was it the Freedom Foundation?
Center for Individual Freedom Foundation.
Center for Individual Freedom Foundation back in Washington, and has written some white papers on the subject of why the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is the most reversed court in the United States. I'm Charles Friedman. Reed, thanks very much for joining us. And this has been the Saturday special on KOMY Watsonville and KSCO Santa Cruz. It's almost 11 o'clock. News Talk comes up after the top of the hour.
USA Radio Network News. Kurt Lewis reporting.
Reorganizing government alone is not enough to make us safe and more secure.
Friday's Senate hearings began with September 11th Commission Chairman Tom Kaine telling Governmental Affairs Committee members that there is no time to lose in implementing the Commission's recommendations.
The enemy is resourceful, flexible. We need a system of management that is as flexible and resourceful as the enemy we face.
Kaine believes power struggles within and between government agencies simply must come to an end.
A fourth round knockout of Mike Tyson.
In Louisville, Kentucky, pugilist Biting Mike was too toothless to even finish that fourth round.
In the boxing ring, yesterday's winner, a 9-1 long shot named Danny Williams. I'm Sarah from Lehman.
At a post office in Cincinnati,
felt the nudity made it impermissible for this to be mailed.
A print of a classic painting showing a partially clad woman printed on a postcard as an invitation to a local art show. A postal worker rejected the mailing, forcing the gallery to re-mail them inside envelopes at the higher letter postage rate. The post office has apologized for the postal worker's misunderstanding of the rules. New York Yankees All-Star first baseman Jason Giambi is on the 15-day disabled list after being diagnosed with a benign tumor. Yankees expect Giambi to return to the diamond later this season. He's been mired in a season-long slump. This is USA Radio Network News.
When was the last time you found quality health insurance? For that matter, when was the last time you found health insurance you could actually afford? Midwest National Life Insurance Company of Tennessee has an offer just for you. Make one toll-free call and find out how much you can save on your health insurance with Midwest. Midwest gives you the same benefits you would expect from most quality health insurance companies. They have affordable rates. However, they let you pick and choose the benefits you need most, so you only pay for the benefits you want. Plus, you get to choose your deductibles. Call now for more information at 800-479-0751. If you're self-employed, Midwest is for you. 800-479-0751. The call is free and there's absolutely no obligation. Call now, 800-479-0751. Rates and availability vary by state. Coverage may not be available in all states. Insurance underwritten by Midwest National Life Insurance Company of Tennessee. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Call now, 800-479-0751.
Wall Street spending the weekend chewing over the preliminary look at second quarter gross domestic product put out by the Bush administration yesterday. While expecting a 3.7% growth, analysts were taken aback by those preliminary reports of just 3.0, and much of that was due to a slip in consumer spending.
Spending for the consumer has slowed down dramatically in the second quarter, just up 1%. Very, very low. Durables was actually down 2.5%, non-durable minus 0.1.
From the conference board, Chief Business Analyst DeLoss Smith thinks it's pretty obvious why consumer spending has been slackening with gasoline prices at record highs in the first half. It simply means smaller amounts available for discretionary spending. World Trade Organization may be on the verge of reaching an agreement to get stalled global trade talks back on track. An all-night negotiating session, key WTO members, including the U.S., have agreed on a package to eliminate farm export subsidies. USA Radio News.
Are you terrible at remembering names? I'm Matthew Girk, America's memory trainer. I'll show you how to meet 50 people or more and remember all their names instantly with the memory switch. Now, in the memory switch, I'll show you how to recall names, dates, facts, figures, even technical data in seconds and remember it for years. Try the memory switch risk-free. Call 1-800-633-7109. Guaranteed or your money back. 1-800-633-7109. 1-800-633-7109.
Delta Airlines has asked its pilots union for wage and benefit concessions.
As one of several struggling major air carriers, Delta is looking for ways to trim costs to keep its nose above water.
Delta Airlines lost nearly $2 billion last quarter. Cuts totaled just over $1 billion a year, including a 35% pay cut for the industry's highest paid pilots. This is Franklin Brown.
And on Wall Street Friday, stocks closing a little higher, even in the face of some conflicting economic news. Even though oil prices hit another record high, the Dow was still able to add 10 points, ending the last trading session of the month at 10,139. Higher tech NASDAQ gained 6 points, ending the week at 1887, while the broader S&P 500 added just over a point, closing at 1101. At the New York Merck oil future contracts closed at $43.80 a barrel, the highest price ever. There's more news at USARadio.com. Kurt Lewis reporting, USA Radio Network News.
Minutes past 11 a.m. and you are listening to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, AM 1340 KOMY Watsonville, and www.kseo.com worldwide. I'm Aaron Bond with a look at your Central Coast weather forecast for today, and it calls for morning low clouds and drizzle, clearing back to the ocean by midday. Otherwise, sunny skies, highs in the 60s along the coast to the mid-80s inland, and an afternoon sea breeze 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight you can expect coastal low clouds spreading into most inland valleys overnight, otherwise clear skies, lows in the 50s to mid-60s, warmest in the hills with an evening sea breeze 10 to 20 miles per hour. For your Monterey Bay boaters forecast today, winds light and variable, becoming west 5 to 15 knots in the afternoon time, wind waves 3 feet or less, swell northwest 2 to 6 feet every 8 seconds, and some patchy morning fog. Looks like it's still clearing off. It's currently 61 degrees here at the station in Santa Cruz, and we take you now back to the Saturday special with your host, Charlie Friedman.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back. KSCO has the
Yes, indeed. That wonderful record show. We play no records whatsoever. This is the Saturday special. Charlie Friedman here with you for the time between now and noon. And we're going to do news talk for this particular hour. It's going to cover whatever you want it to cover. We can investigate or elaborate on some of the issues that were discussed during the previous hour when Reed Cox was our guest, and we were talking about the Ninth Circuit Court in particular and judicial issues in general. We can do more of that. Or, of course, we can talk about the political campaign, Governor Schwarzenegger's plans for reform up in Sacramento. Anything that occurs to you, I'll throw a few things out there and count on you to pick up the ball and run with it. The telephone number, for those of you who would like to join me here on the radio and make the program better by so doing, 479-1080, that is 479-1080. We also have a line 477-1340. Either of those will get you on the air right away. And if you have something you'd like to fax to me, you may do so at 475-2967. The last hour was really very informative, particularly when we had the one caller, Mark from Watsonville, call up and tell us about a case coming up before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that he said he'd read about in the papers, and by golly, I'd missed it somehow, but it's an interesting one. Let me see if I've got it right the way he posed it. There's a woman from Mexico who is pregnant, and she's being deported back to Mexico. But she's claiming that since her child was conceived in the United States, that the child is going to be a U.S. citizen. Although, when the child is born, if she's deported, she'll be in Mexico. The child will be born in Mexico, but she's saying because it was conceived here in this country, the child will be a U.S. citizen. And our Ninth Circuit Court is going to get to make a decision on this. So they're going to have to decide between their liberalism on immigration policy and their liberalism on who's a human being and when are they a human being. That's going to be a fascinating one. So we'll have to keep a close eye on that. And I want to thank Mark in Salinas for calling and alerting us to that. Let me see here. We do have a caller, Fred in Salinas. Fred, come on.
There we go. Gracious golly, sometimes you got to push those buttons hard. Hi, Fred. Thanks for calling the Saturday Special.
Yes, good morning. I'll tell you, I want to put out a question.
Yeah.
And see if anybody can explain what it's all about.
And what's that?
I've been watching German television, and I've been seeing that the Germans...
Are you by any chance a cat?
No, I got a barking dog.
It appears that you've excited the animal somehow there.
Yeah, I've been watching German television, and I have noticed that they're changing their work hour from 35 to 40 hours a week, but holding their pay at the same scale. And I want to, I just want to know if anybody knows what that means. This, it means something, and I just can't quite figure it out. Do you have any idea what's going on there?
Well, a little bit. Germany has been suffering from some severe economic doldrums, even going back to before the reunification that happened, 14 years ago now, was it? That
yes.
East Germany became part of Germany again. But what happened was that West Germany had set up this really cradle-to-grave social assistance program, and also they had cut their working hours back to, you know, like you mentioned, a 35-hour work week. They also take a lot of vacations during the year, etc.
Uh-huh.
The German people, the German workers, I think they literally put in something like only two-thirds the amount of hours that, say, Americans do. It's a very, very huge difference.
Yeah.
Of course, right now, Americans, in all fairness, Americans are the extreme example. Nobody in this world works harder than Americans. The Japanese used to, but we caught and passed them a long time ago. Anyway, but the Germans have been going way far the other way. Now, they've got a situation right now where their unemployment rate is about 9.5% and has been that way for years, like 5 or 6 years. They have no economic growth going on. It's not shrinking either, but zero economic growth just does not make it. And so there's a social democratic government in Germany right now under Chancellor Schroeder. And this social democratic government has been faced with the to it unpalatable task of beginning to try to cut back on some of these social benefits, hours off, et cetera, et cetera. Now, from what you're saying, evidently, they're trying to go to a 40-hour work week but maintain the same pay. What that amounts to is we're gonna get more work out of you.
You're going to get more work out of them with the same amount of money.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if they can manage that, you see, the thing is that a lot of people don't want to do that. They get used to the idea of having it easy. So if it's the way you presented it here, and I don't know because I haven't seen this in the paper, but then again, watching German television, you would tend to get more of a slant on these issues than you would by reading American newspapers.
Uh-huh.
But I'll keep my eyes open for something on that because
I just thought it was quite strange. My sister used to have a German exchange student, and you know, I got to spend a lot of time talking about Germany. She was from Frankfurt, and they have long lunch hours, and they have long vacations, and but you know, if you go to higher output, you're going to have less. I think you have less jobs, but you know, with people having to produce more.
Tell you what, we've got another caller here, Millie from Rio Del Mar. She says she wants to dispute something that you've come up with here.
Okay,
let's see if we can. Doggone it. There we go. Millie, are you there?
Yes.
Well, bless your heart. Why don't you go ahead and tell Fred what it is that you had a problem with?
I could be very wrong about this, but I heard various comments on FM news commentaries, and my understanding is that in Germany, the hours have been reduced to 35 with the same pay. And if I'm wrong, I apologize to the caller.
No, this is what I understood. Is I know they have been on a reduced work week for years, but their plan was to go from 35 to 40 hour work week, but keep the same pay, is what I understood. I was watching a German DW television called DW, but it's spoken in English. And that was the exact, that's sure what I understood was that.
Well, I'm probably wrong about this. Maybe it's France that, but this exact ratio was described over the news.
Uh-huh.
And I wish I could still, on my cable TV, get the German news.
Well,
like you're getting it. But
I tell you where I'm
gone.
I'm getting it on the Access TV. It's like channel 26 in the evening.
And mine was on Access also. And well, I'll try 26.
It's 25, 26, 27, somewhere
yes.
in there.
Yeah. Well,
but it's like at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, something like that.
Well, like I said, if I'm wrong about this, excuse me, but that's how I understood it. But maybe I'm confusing it with France.
I think it's possible, Millie, because I know for quite some time now, Germany has had, as Fred described, an abbreviated work week. This is one of the benefits that, as a matter of fact, have just about bankrupted the country, particularly since the reunification, when all of these benefits were extended to the population of East Germany, fully funded.
Uh-huh.
And this was just a tremendous bite for the West German economy to absorb, and quite literally the West German economy got indigestion and has had it ever since.
Well, for such hustling, hardworking people as the Germans are.
Or have been.
Well, I don't see how they could have changed entirely. However, I think part of it is the immigrant problem draining away their money. So many Turks coming in and having children and staying there, and you know.
Bear in mind, it was official German government policy to encourage that immigration.
And it was a mistake.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Thanks, Fred. Thanks, Millie.
Okay, I just wish maybe some of the, there's some wise ones out there that could explain why this system's happening. I don't quite understand why they have to go to more production per unit, but
because they are bankrupt and they need poor production.
That's probably it.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you don't adopt a measure like that unless you've hit the wall.
Yeah.
And the German economy has been hitting the wall for quite some time now. It's interesting, you know, the Japanese, the Germans, and the French have all been
suffering from
a lot of economic distress over the last few years, and in the case particularly of the Germans and the French, it's for the basically the same reason: too large a social envelope and too many benefits, and not enough work being done to pay for it. In Japan, you had this situation where banks were loaning sums on real estate in Tokyo and other cities in Japan, which was valued at these incredible amounts, and this real estate would be used as collateral for loans of billions and billions of yen. And then suddenly, a couple of these loans started to come due, and people would say, well, I guess I'll just sell the real estate, pay off the loan. When the real estate went on the market, it wouldn't bring anywhere near what had been lent on it. And, you know, all this had to do was happen once or twice, and then everybody holding that paper goes, oh, my God, we got us a King Kong problem here. And the next thing you know, you had this massive liquidity crisis. This all hit in Japan about, let me see, this is 2004. This hit in Japan about 1992, 1993, something like that. And for the last 10 years, Japan, which used to be this roaring, you know, 6 and 8% growth a year economy, has been a stagnant economy primarily because they're choking on all this bad debt. And government after government there has tried to come up with some way of doing something about it and solving this liquidity crisis and getting the economy back on the footing where it can, again, provide the kind of employment and prosperity and rising standards of living that the Japanese in the post-war world have become accustomed to and have worked very hard for. And it just hasn't been working out. There's another government right there now. Mr. Koizumi has got another package of reforms that he hopes We'll have some way of conquering this. But right now, I'll tell you, the United States of America, of all the major industrial nations of the world, economically speaking, we are far better off than our friends in Japan, far better off than our friends in France or Germany. We should count our blessings. Economically, we are the leader in the world right now.
which I hope we can keep it there.
By golly, so do I.
Have a good day.
And you too. Thank you very much for joining us. We did have a caller, Bill, who was on the line for a moment, dropped off. I'm hoping he will join us again. For that matter, I'm hoping you might join us. The telephone number here is 479-1080. That's 479-1080. And between now and noon, it's News Talk here on the Saturday Special, and the topics are pretty much up in the air. So incredibly well-informed on just about anything you could possibly mention that I'm sure that you'll receive erudite comment and elucidation no matter what subject you care to bring up. And if you'd like any more BS, I've got plenty. Aha! Asa in Live Oak is on. Why don't we go ahead and talk with her for a moment or two? Go ahead and put the lady on hold and we'll get her on up here. Oh, Sam's still talking with her. Well, she's a personable individual. You can join us on our little talk fest here at 479-1080. We are going to be I'm going to be doing a program with you today from 2 to 3 called Leap to Faith. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to hear that program or not. It's sponsored by the local Lutheran churches, and what we do is we take a piece of scripture that will be discussed in the services tomorrow. We examine it, look at it, try to relate it to our present-day lives. If you get a chance to join us later on in the afternoon for Leap to Faith between 2 and 3, I'd appreciate it a lot. Hey, say, you through talking with Sam now? Want to talk to me? Hi there. Are you there?
This is Asa.
That's right.
Did you say Sam? I thought you said Sam.
I said you were talking with Sam. I see you through talking with Sam.
Oh, okay.
Now you can talk with me. How are you doing today?
You just tricked me. I have to ask you something because you just said that Germany, France, and Japan were in this terrible fix because they'd done a socialist thing, which is something I totally understand.
In the case of France and Germany, that's primarily it. With Japan, as I explained,
it's
a liquidity crisis based on overvaluation of some real estate that they made these huge loans on and then found out, gee, the value isn't there.
But what you said was how much better off we are, and I, for one, I feel that we have done well in the productivity thing because our people produce more and because we've had the leanness, you know, the corporations cutting down and getting their balance sheet straight when they weren't crooked. Anyway.
And bear in mind that most corporations aren't crooked.
Well, I
the ones we that. The ones we hear about are the ones where the Canlays of the world are working their wonders, or the Global Crossing, or some of those others. For every one of those, there's a hundred or a thousand that are just, you know, doing their jobs and paying their workers.
I just don't know if the accountants have gotten themselves straight. I mean, they're such a brainy group. It's hard to figure them out. But I hope they've mended their ways too.
Well, perhaps we can get Noah. Have him build another ark and put all the lawyers and accountants both in it.
Wouldn't that be something?
My
we could ship them off.
Talk about heaven on earth. Heaven
anyway,
on earth.
Anyway, I thought you're right from the point of view that right now we appear to be because we have a more honest economy. On the other hand,
also much less unemployment here.
Yes, but we have this absolutely prodigious debt. If anybody were to call our loans, the wall we hit would collapse.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard the old saying, the richer you are, the more you owe?
I've heard that,
I'll
yes.
tell you, I know some people. So help me God, I know some people who don't owe any money. And most of them are living hand-to-mouth existences out in the Santa Cruz Mountains, you know, living in lean-tos. Then again, right now I have a mortgage on my house, so I owe a considerable amount of money, but, you know, I actually am very happy with my standard of living right now, although, you know, if the bank called my loan tomorrow, I'd be up against it. On the other hand, they're not going to do that because it's not in their interest.
As long as you have the income to make the payments.
As long as I make the payments every month, they're happy. It's the simplest thing in the world.
County doesn't decide on another fee.
Well, now, this is something that, I got a kick out of this. This happened to me a couple of years ago. I had a dream. I was in college again. And I was in college, and I was going to these classes, and I was making notes, and I was thinking to myself, well, I've got this term paper I've got to do, and I've got this project due, and I have to be ready for this examination and everything. And then Max jumped on me. Max is my cat. And I woke up in a cold sweat, and I was just so nervous with all that. I looked around, and I thought, oh, gosh, all I have to do is pay the mortgage. Thank God.
Well,
Mo better. But now, getting back to the point you were making, Asa, the more money you have, the wealthier you are, the more you owe. You look at a guy like Donald Trump. I'll bet Donald Trump has debts of millions of dollars.
I'm sure.
But and now transfer that to the case of the United States of America. You talk about our national debt, which is exactly what you are alluding to.
And its unfunded liabilities.
National debt is about $6 trillion right now. But if you look at our national debt as a percentage of gross national product, it's actually less than it was a few years ago, because our gross national product has increased so prodigiously. And one other thing you mentioned that I think is a very good point that ought to be underlined, you talked about growth and productivity. Now, this is something that you don't hear talked about as often as you should. Normally, you think about economic growth. It's real nice if you can get 3 or 4, 4.5% a year economic growth. Generally, productivity, you can expect something like a 3 or 4, 4.5% growth in productivity from year to year. Over the past 4 years, we have seen productivity grow anywhere from 8 to 14% per year.
What are we producing?
We're producing more of everything. Our GNP, our product in the United States, gets bigger every year.
That's what they tell me.
This country, we're working harder, we're producing more than we ever have before. And I'll give you another little treat that most people aren't aware of. Right now, the number of people working in the United States, the number of people employed in this country, is at an all-time high today. There have never been more people working before than there are right now.
I know that.
You knew that one, huh?
I'm still confused. I'm still a little bit confused about the fact that the only reason we are afloat is because all these other people are buying our bonds. If China quit buying our bonds, if Japan quit buying our bonds, I mean, what if they decided not to buy our bonds?
Okay, look at it this way. Let's say that you have money and you're going to buy a bond, okay?
Okay.
Just for the sake of argument.
Okay.
Okay, so Asa has $1,000 and she's going to buy a bond. You look at various bonds and you make a decision as to what bond to buy. What criteria are you going to use?
How much interest does it pay?
You're also going to think about security and safety. I mean, some guy might come along and say, I'll pay you 15%, but you look at it and it's some kind of a junk bond. It's fly-by-night.
Yeah.
That's what junk bonds are, incidentally. Junk bonds are bonds where the risk is very high, but the interest is also very high. They'll pay you a tremendous amount, but you assume a tremendous risk of losing your money. But now, I don't know about you. I'm 52. I don't want to lose my money. So if I'm looking at an investment, yeah, sure, I'm going to look at the interest rate, but I'm also going to look at where will my money be most secure? Where can I get the most secure return? And this is why America has this tremendous external debt, is because people all over the world, in other places, from Europe to Asia to the islands of the Pacific, every place else, they look at all the various places on Earth and say, where do we want to invest our money? And the answer comes back in a big roaring gush, the United States of America.
Well,
because the United States of America is the safest, most secure, and most profitable investment you can make in the world. And that's why people invest their money here. And you can't blame them, because you know all these things are true.
I know all these things are true. There's absolutely no doubt, except that I, as an American citizen, can't make any, in other words, as a senior citizen, can't make a nickel off of any money I put anywhere.
That's because interest rates are low right now. You have investments that
you've
been living off of?
You have a negative income half the time.
You have investments you've been living off of?
Well, yeah.
See, people who are in your position over the last couple of years have really taken it in the neck.
You bet.
Yeah, it's one of those old stories about the two-edged sword. I'm reminded back 20 years ago, after President Reagan deregulated all the oil and gas prices, and it was about 1983 or so, all of a sudden the gas prices started coming down and down and down and down. Price of a barrel of oil went from like $38 down to $18. And this was great for most people. It was great for you and me. You know, when we fill up our gas tanks, we were paying less for gas and so on. People in the Northeast paying less for home heating oil. You name it. But you know who really took it in the neck were people in states like Louisiana and Texas, where they produce oil. So, you know, it's an ill wind that blows everyone bad or no one good or whatever.
Well,
low interest rates are good for the economy in general.
Low interest rates mean that people can borrow money and finance houses and business expansion, etc., and money is cheap. But to the number of people, like yourself, who are trying to earn an income off of interest investments, it is a god-awful time.
Well, it's an interesting time, is all I have to say. It requires nimbleness to try to get 3% or something like that. I mean, it is just crazy. And the fact is that the dollar keeps being worth less and less. And I keep thinking, why is the dollar worth less than we're the richest people? But then you got to. It's a very confused thing to me when I look and I say, each day that, you know, the price of the dollar goes down, and it's worth less and less, and everybody keeps telling me that I belong to the richest nation on earth.
The dollar fluctuates against other currencies. Right now the dollar is priced low against other currencies. Presently that'll change, and other currencies will depreciate in regard to the dollar. We've seen high and low-cost dollars over the years.
Oh, I know. It's just that at the time when all of the politicians are talking about how rich we are, our dollar keeps falling. I keep thinking, what do they mean? And it's all. I just have to say, anyway, I think it's an interesting topic. I don't know what the answer to anything is, except that, as the old saying goes, you keep on keeping on.
Well, you got that right, and I want to thank you very much for calling, Asa.
Thank you for being there.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
That's Asa over in Live Oak. She calls here at the radio station fairly often, and we're always glad to hear from her because she always has such a sunny outlook on things. Even when she has some questions to ask that she doesn't like the answers to, she still manages to have a good laugh out of it. I've got a fax I'm going to share with you here in a few minutes when I come back. We're going to take a little break right now, get a little business out of the way. This is the Saturday special. I'm Charles Friedman. We're doing News Talk for the next half hour here on KSCO and KOMY.
My name is Kathy, and I met my husband Michael at eHarmony.com.
My name is Gina, and I met my husband Tom through eHarmony.com.
My name's Jennifer, and I met my husband Jack on eHarmony.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Neil Clark Warren, founder of eHarmony.com. These are just a few of the hundreds of eHarmony marriages. Dating services give you a picture in a paragraph. We go a lot deeper. We start with a personality profile that features 29 dimensions of compatibility, crucial to a long-term relationship. And if you go to eHarmony.com right now, we'll give you this $40 profile free. And then we'll find you a soulmate based on compatibility in the most important areas of life. Visit eHarmony.com today. Get your free personality profile.
My name is Becky, and I met my husband, Tom, on eHarmony.com.
A lot of happy guys out there tonight, thanks to eHarmony.com.
This is a standing invitation to all of you to join me every Sunday for the brunch at the Embassy of the New World Order. Greetings to you conversationalists, thinkers, and otherwise interested. I'm Cyril Vitomsky, your progressive and multicultural ambassador of the New World Order, host of the one and only Foreign Affairs radio show, Where All Politics Are Global. Since the embassy is virtual, and the brunch is virtual too, so you serve your own champagne, caviar, and eggs benedict, and no attire is required at all. Mark your calendars every Sunday at 11 a.m., Embassy of the New World Order, right here on KSCO.
Buying a home around here is an expensive proposition. Hi, I'm Jim Chubb with Pacific Inland. I've been helping people save money on home loans for nearly 20 years, and I'd like to help you save money on your next home purchase. Right now, Pacific Inland has special programs that are helping people save real money when they buy a home. Call Pacific Inland at 831-475-2600, and we'll tailor one of these programs to help you buy a home. That's Pacific Inland at 475-2600, licensed by the California Department of Real Estate.
And now back to the Saturday special with Charlie Friedman.
Thank you very much, Aaron. And we did have a fax arrive just a few moments ago. Incidentally, if you want to send a fax, 475-2967 is the number. If you want to call me, it's 479-1080, and we'll be on the air with Rory in Watsonville in just a moment. But first, let's see what this say here. It's backwards, so I got to hold it up to the light to read it. Charlie, if lighting up a flag in public is free political speech, wouldn't lighting up a cigarette be the same? Signed, Ken in Carmel. Well, Ken, given how political smoking has become these days, I imagine there's a way that you could make that case. Of course, burning a flag is definitely political speech, and when we were talking about that in the last hour, it's political speech with which I profoundly disagree. The American flag represents all that holds us together, our rights to disagree with one another, our rights to think as we do, to pray as we do, to act as we do. And when you flambe the American flag, essentially you're saying, I want a totalitarian state. I am frustrated because I can't have my way about everything because you won't do what I tell you to do. Therefore, this American flag that lets you do what you want to do in spite of what I want you to do, well, there's something wrong with that, so we're going to torch the flag here. A few years ago, on KOMY, KSCO, I used to indulge occasionally in programs with Eric Scheck. Eric would come from the left, I would come from the political right, and we would debate these issues. Eric brought up the flag-burning issue one time. It was au courant at the time, being before the Supreme Court. And I don't know what he expected me to say. He knows me pretty well. He probably had an idea, but he put it to me. He said, you know, some people are claiming that political speech has to be words, that, you know, it has to be really speech, and that other communications don't qualify. So I made a gesture to Eric, and I said on the air, Eric, I've got to say that I believe that communication doesn't necessarily have to be verbal. For example, just now, I am making a communication to you, which I'm sure you understand quite well, and there's not a word being spoken. And Eric kind of laughed and said, that's a lovely finger you have there, Charles. And the point was well taken, though, because there is plenty of communication that can take place without ever opening your mouth. And as a matter of fact, experts in communication will tell you that most communication, if it's two people standing face to face, is nonverbal. It's the way they look, their expressions, their inflections, like the way I'm using inflection right now in my voice, helps communicate what I'm attempting to say to you. Even though I can't see you, if I could see you, you'd be able to look in my eyes, you'd be able to see the way I'm gesturing, and so on and so forth. Hey, you want to see somebody speak nonverbal? Look at an Italian sometime. Look at all the gestures they use. My goodness gracious, guys can talk with their hands. Okay, we got a bunch of callers now. We're going to get to them right away. Rory in Watsonville. Hi there. Thank you for your patience.
You bet. Good day, Charlie. Quick question, and kind of tag along with Asa's previous comments about...
Rory, can I interrupt you for a second? What's that? Okay, it just stopped. Go ahead. There was every time you speak, there's some kind of a rattlesnake noise on the line.
You know what? That's the new Motorola hands-free unit that's flaky.
Oh, but well, anyway. It just stopped. Anyway, go ahead and make your point, please.
Yeah, no, Asa was talking about how, you know, we're the richest country.
Oops. I'm afraid the Motorola people didn't do you a lot of good there, Rory. Give it another try calling in. Either that or see if you can fight your way to a phone booth and drop a dime on us. We're going to move on to the next call. Bob in Soquel, thank you very kindly for being with us today. What can I do for you?
Good show, Charlie. Especially the first hour.
Thank you.
I wanted to call the first hour, but I was busy doing something else.
Is this Bob Listener?
Yes.
Hi, how you doing? Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, Charlie.
What can I do for you today? Good to have you.
Well, I want to expand on what Mr. Cox said a little bit about the Ninth Circuit Court and the Constitution, if I could.
Please do.
Well, when the framers wrote the Constitution, they felt that the judicial power should be invested in the Supreme Court, all inferior courts, and that was their function and nothing else. But there's a little bit more to that. I believe, and I think you probably do too, that the Supreme Court does not make laws. It just interprets laws. And that's what the Founding Fathers intended, for the Supreme Court to interpret laws. According to the Federalist Papers, number 78, as a matter of fact, the Supreme Court, this was written by Alexander Hamilton, the Supreme Court, or the only inferior courts, have neither the power of the sword nor the purse. They just have the power to render opinions. So if the executive branch wants to, and that includes, as it applies to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, it doesn't have to follow the dictates of the courts.
That's correct, and I can cite you an example of President Andrew Jackson one time. Yeah,
Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, where he moved the Cherokees to Oklahoma.
Yeah, the court has made their ruling, now let them enforce it, and he proceeded to do what he damn well pleased.
That's exactly right, and I think this has happened from time to time, so I have this one caveat with Mr. Cox, and that is that the courts, you hear people say that the Supreme Court and the other courts, the Ninth Circuit, makes laws. They don't make laws, they interpret the laws. They have no power to make anybody do anything.
Actually, the only power they have is in public acceptance. We've gotten to a point now, and this is something that I've wondered about from time to time, because we have certainly, I think you'd agree with me, we have seen cases in the past few years where courts have obviously and definitely overstepped their bounds. The best example I can come up with, you just quoted Hamilton. He says the courts have neither power of neither gun nor purse. In other words, courts don't impose taxes. As a matter of fact, presidents or governors don't do that. Power of the purse is in the legislature. Now, you probably read about that case. It was in Kansas City a few years ago. There was some case brought before a judge there having to do with financing the local schools, and the judge decided, well, local schools don't have enough money, and he proceeded to issue a tax increase.
That's something that has to, the way you rectify that.
Now, if that isn't an outrageous abuse of the legislative power, I don't know what is.
Well, I have to come back to what I said. All they're doing is rendering an opinion. The way to rectify that is for the legislature to pass another law or for a higher court to overturn that decision. Because they can't force the legislature to impose a tax or do anything unless the legislature decides to do it, or if the governor introduces a bill or a tax bill.
And then gets it passed.
That's exactly right. So all I'm saying here, Charlie,
yeah,
is that the courts can't make anybody do anything. They just render opinions. What the hell can they do in their black robes? And, you know, and I don't have all the figures on this because I can't, I have macular degeneration. I can't study this stuff like I used to.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that your guest continues to allege is that the courts, the Ninth Circuit Court has been overturned many, many times.
Well, that's true.
The Ninth Circuit Court has been overturned many, many times.
Yes.
The Ninth Circuit Court is like all the other courts. It can't make anybody do anything. And what they do, what the Ninth Circuit Court, now correct me if I'm wrong on this, most of the Ninth Circuit Court were probably appointed by, Jimmy Carter?
Most of the Ninth Circuit Court was appointed by President Clinton. And,
there you go.
And also by Mr. Carter. So yeah, it does predominate with Democratic appointees. You're correct.
Well, some very important decisions have been overturned by present court. I'm surprised, for example, that your guest didn't mention the Warren Court at all. Now, the Warren Court overturned some very popular decisions, namely the Dred Scott decision and Plessy versus Ferguson, which involved equal protection of the law under the Constitution because African Americans weren't given their rights.
Plessy Ferguson is a really good example of a decision that was overturned specifically by the Supreme Court and done on a unanimous vote. But in that particular case, the Supreme Court wasn't overturning another district, a district court or something like that. The Supreme Court was actually overturning a previous Supreme Court.
That's true. You know.
Yeah.
Do you know the background on why they got the 9-0 decision on that?
Yeah, I've looked into it. The one thing that was valuable in it, and you know, in some ways, this was it became a bad thing later on because Earl Warren, in my opinion, was a man who was in the wrong place. Earl Warren, you hear about the term judiciary temperament when they nominate a guy to be on a court or the Supreme Court or something. They say, well, does he have a judicial temperament? Earl Warren had an executive temperament.
Exactly. I was wondering if you were going to bring that up.
Earl Warren was probably the second greatest governor California's ever had.
Agreed. Even though he was a Republican.
He was the second greatest governor this state has ever had, and the greatest one was a Republican, too, I would remind you. That was Hiram Johnson. But
I'm very familiar with Hiram Johnson.
I knew you would be. I don't know if our listeners are or not, but I have plenty of respect for your historical knowledge. I know damn well you know who he is and what he did.
My grandfather was his campaign manager.
No kidding. But anyway, Warren was an executive, and that's why he was such a successful governor. But when he became Supreme Court Justice, he took that executive viewpoint with him. And he attacked the job of Supreme Court Chief Justice not as a judicial figure, but as an executive figure. And it led, in my opinion, to him getting that the Plessy-Ferguson decision overturned Brown versus Board of Education, which was a tremendous benefit. And I think that decision probably would have been taken even if Warren hadn't been there to poke it through, although his efforts were invaluable. But later on, when, for example, they issued a ruling that all of the legislatures, all of the states had to reapportion not just one, but both houses of their legislatures along a one-man, one-vote proposition.
Baker versus Kahn and Asbury versus Sanders and Gray versus Sanders.
That was outrageous. I can understand the court saying that one house of a legislature has to be apportioned that way. But even at that, the Constitution gives the federal government and the federal courts no right to tell a state how to make up its legislature.
Well, wait a minute now.
But the idea of saying that both houses have to be made up in the same way, I mean, why doesn't the Supreme Court come along and now and say, well, California ought to have 12 U.S. senators and the rest of the other states can go suck hind tit?
Let's go back to the reapportionment decision.
Sure.
Regarding the state senator of California?
Yep.
What you're talking about?
Yeah, we used to have, we have 58 counties, we have 40 senators in the state senate.
Let me give you an example as to why they made that decision. L.A. County had one state senator.
That's right.
And those cow counties of Inyo, Mono, and one other county each had one senator.
Mono, Inyo, and Alpine had one senator together.
That's right.
Remember, there's 58 counties and 40 senators, so there did have to be some counties clumped together.
That's right.
So but bear in mind, the state of California has two senators. The state of Wyoming, with 350,000 people living in it, has two senators. It's not the job of the upper house of the federal legislature to represent population. The House does that. In the Senate, other interests are the state interests are represented. Now, in California, prior to that decision, it was the same way here. Our assembly didn't have one member from L.A. County and one member from Modoc County. Our assembly was apportioned by population, and a preponderance of it came from the more populous areas, as it should. But the state Senate safeguarded the interests of the northern part of the state and the more rural part of the state. Today, I mean, right now, under this thing, the only state legislature in this country that makes any damn sense is the one in Nebraska.
Well, this decision applied, I guess it didn't apply to California.
Oh, it applied to every state.
Right,
we had to reapportion our legislature, right. Both houses. That was happened in 1966. You remember it quite well.
Because they can't do that on a federal level, but there may be an argument that should be done on the state level because each of the states do not have a federal form of government. And it's not the same, in a way, it's not the same thing. It wasn't written into the U.S. Constitution that all states have to follow the federal example.
No, it wasn't. You're right. You're right, it wasn't. And that's why the Supreme Court outstepped its bounds outrageously in that decision. And that's one example of why I think when you look at Earl Warren, you've got to respect the man's effectiveness and et cetera, but you've got to also say he was the right man in the wrong place.
Well, you know what he did, besides what you mentioned?
Hmm.
How he used that executive ability to get the decision he wanted in that decision. He went around to each of the justices and persuaded them individually, or at least most of them.
Yeah, he lobbied them.
He lobbied them. He went to Justice Frankfurter, who, believe it or not, was not going to agree with him on that. He went around to all the others, I guess, and he persuaded them. So that's how he got the 9-0 decision. Charlie, you and I could talk about this all day, I guess, but I guess you got other callers.
I got Dennis and Live Oak coming up next.
Okay, well, you have a good one, Charlie. Talking to you.
Thanks for calling. I appreciate it, Bob.
Bye.
We're going to get right on to our next caller. I want to remind you that lines are open here at KSCOKOMY. 479-1080 is the telephone number. I'm Charlie Friedman. This is a Saturday special. We're doing News Talk, and the next person we're doing it with is Dennis in Live Oak. Hello, Dennis.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Charlie.
Yes.
God, I want to change the whole thing.
That's okay. You can do that.
Yeah,
go right ahead.
We keep suffering with this Highway 1 widening.
Oh, okay. You want to talk about that? Please do. Go ahead.
Well, I'll make it brief and get off the line and let somebody else talk. But I am so frustrated with our supervisors and, you know, city councils that have just say one thing and they're doing another, not widening Highway 1.
Okay, let me ask you a question or two, Dennis. How do you feel about widening Highway 1? Are you for it or against it?
I'm for it.
You're for it.
I'm against zero growth in Santa Cruz County.
Well, zero.
No more new houses because we don't have the infrastructure for them anymore.
Bear in mind that zero growth has never occurred in San
Francisco. I agree. I'm not going to tell somebody they can't build a house. My God, I mean, I won't tell anybody they can't move to Santa Cruz County, but, you know, it's getting worse and worse all the time.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm 52. When I was born, Highway 1 from Aptos into Santa Cruz was two lanes each way. Right now, Highway 1 from Aptos into Santa Cruz is two lanes each way. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That is crazy. I noticed in the paper the other day the supervisors had placed a measure on the ballot providing for a half-cent sales tax, additional sales tax, in Santa Cruz County for the purpose of financing that road widening of Highway 1 from Aptos in and also a couple of other transport measures. Exactly. I am definitely going to vote for that. Now, being a conservative, I'm generally anti-tax. I like to keep taxes as low as possible. On the other hand, if you come up with something that is, first of all, definitely government business, and the public streets and roads are government business, you come up with a definite need, and I see a definite need, and I think anybody who ever tries to navigate Highway 1 sees a definite need, then by God, I'm willing to pay the bill. I will vote for that tax, and I will cheerfully pay the tax for the purpose of having Highway 1 into Santa Cruz widened.
Yes, sir. I agree with you. I'm not voting for, don't generally vote for any tax increase for anybody. I don't generally vote yes on a bond.
That's me too. We're coming from the same place, Dennis.
This is one I would definitely vote for. This is one I'll support. And the only other thing I'd like to see them do, if they don't do this and they don't get on their ball and do this, they should start exploring ways to go underground with a freeway. Because, the biggest thing is a lot of problems that started back with Gary Patton and widening and repairing a fish hook. You know, we don't want people coming down the freeway to see Santa Cruz or Santa Cruz to see the freeway.
Tell me something. Are you in a car?
Yeah.
You're fading in and out wherever you are.
Over. I'm just done anyway. I just like to see him get
Okay, I'm afraid we just lost Dennis. On the other hand, thank heaven, he did have an opportunity to make his point. Talking about the proposal to raise the county sales tax by half a cent on the dollar in order to raise money to finance a widening of Highway 1. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't honestly see how anybody can be against this. Even if you're an anti-growth person, even if you're a rabidly anti-growth person, you have to understand the growth. It's not a matter of trying to prevent or prohibit or ameliorate growth. The growth has already occurred. We're not talking about building an extra lane onto the highway because we may need it in the future or because additional populations may need it in the future. Actually, I would like to find some way to make this retroactive. That extra lane on Highway 1 was needed about 15 years ago. And again, if you don't believe that's so, then try driving on Highway 1, particularly during peak traffic hours. But for that matter, even when it isn't 8 o'clock in the morning, even when it isn't 4:30 in the afternoon, try navigating Highway 1 in Santa Cruz and up to Soquel or so, past 41st Avenue, all the way down to where Aptos is. And you will find that even if the traffic is moving, it's incredibly heavy. And incredibly heavy traffic of that nature creates a dangerous situation. People tend to tailgate. I mean, no matter what your situation, there will always be a jackrabbit driver. You try to leave a little following room and somebody dives into it. How many times has that happened to you? And for that matter, every time they dive into it in front of you, the first thing to do is always slam on their brakes. I've never been able to understand that, but for some reason they seem to feel that's obligatory. We have open lines here at KSCOKOMY. Right now it's 479-1080. That is 479-1080, the telephone number. And as our previous caller amply proved, we are perfectly happy to have you steer the conversation here in any direction you choose. This is a news talk hour, therefore any issue you care to bring up, whether it's state, federal, or local, whether it's international, is entirely welcome. We had a caller who wanted to talk about widening Highway 1. Before that, we had Bob Listener, who was talking about the Supreme Court, some of their rulings. So if you want to shift the gears, you go right ahead and shift the gears. I noticed in the newspaper that our governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is now embarking on a plan to remake or to really reform state government by streamlining a lot of the boards and commissions that have been built up over the years. The estimated savings over a period of, the estimated savings over a period of 4 or 5 years was something on the order of $6 billion. That's just about enough to close the budget gap. I had no idea they were wasting that money on those boards and commissions. We have a call from Tom in Santa Cruz. Tom, thank you very much for joining us. What's on your mind today, sir?
I just caught up with the show. I heard someone, I think named Bob, actually saying that judges had no power.
What he was saying is that judges don't have the power to command police forces, judges don't have the power to command armies and so on.
Well, obviously the man's never been near a courtroom.
Well, they have court bailiffs, yes. But the one thing that he was making clear, and that I tried to raise the point, the power of a court is in the public acceptance of the court and its legitimacy.
Well, I don't think so.
Let me give you an example. A few years ago, when Richard Nixon was president.
Well, I know. Excuse me, but I know the theory. But
yeah.
But for instance, if someone he quoted Andrew Jackson, or you did, if you're Andrew Jackson, of course you can say that. But I think if he tries that, or anybody tries that. Says the court has made its ruling, now let them enforce it, I think they'll learn very differently.
You know, it's a curiosity. I can't help but wonder, particularly if you took a case where there was an obvious preponderance of public opinion. For example, we've had a lot of conversation today on the Pledge of Allegiance case, which was originally brought before the Ninth Circuit Court. I don't know if you had a chance to hear our first hour or not, but we had a guest who has made a study of the Ninth Circuit Court and its high reversal rate, and he specifically alluded to that case once or twice. Now, in this particular case, the Ninth Circuit ruled that the words "under God" had to be taken out of the Pledge of Allegiance because, essentially, some cornball bought a lawsuit and says, I don't want to hear it. I can't help but wonder what might have happened if the President of the United States had said, you can take that opinion and you can put it where the sun don't shine, and I would like people in the country to still keep saying the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. Most of the people I know, when they say the pledge, still say the words "under God," whether they do so out of a conscious effort to defy the court or simply out of habit of years. I think you'd have people on both sides of that. But the fact is that the court cannot hear everybody who says the pledge, and certainly I don't see them sending round officers to herd up people who use the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah, well, that's there's a good sort of unimportant example.
Well, it's important to some people. The example I was going to make, though, years ago when Nixon was president.
You can say anything. The point is that you can say anything you want between consenting adults or wherever, or in the privacy of your bedroom. It's the same thing as this nonsense about gay marriage. It's obvious that if civil union and marriage mean the same thing, in civil terms, in other words, the state cannot perform a religious marriage, and that's usually the way the term is. However, it does have a civil union, which it calls marriage, and obviously any two people can say that they're married,
mm-hmm.
and there's no problem. The point is if they're being actually denied certain benefits that come from marriage, that's a whole different matter. If in other words, civil union does not mean marriage, or doesn't mean it in every state, and so on, people have a right. That's their civil right, is to be able to have a civil union, if anyone else is able to.
I agree with that, but there must be some difference between the two, because I'll tell you what. A few years ago, when the state of Vermont passed a bill, governor signed the bill, permitting civil unions in Vermont between same-sex couples.
Uh-huh.
You saw a few people on the far right get very upset about that. But you didn't see anybody in Congress, for example, saying, well, we've got to do something and, prohibit that. You didn't see anything like that. You didn't see, the president saying, well, this is the end of the Western civilization or anything like that. Nothing like that happened until the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts found in the Constitution of Massachusetts, somehow found it, been there all along, but they found it, that the state of Massachusetts mandates marriage between same-sex couples. So there is a difference. There's also a difference in the way it was done. I mean, Vermont did it right. The legislature brings up a law, it's debated, it's passed, the governor signs it, and by God, it's a law.
State of Massachusetts doesn't mandate marriage.
The state of Massachusetts Supreme Court did precisely that.
It permits it.
No, mean
it mandates it?
Mandates marriage.
You have to be married if you're a couple.
No, I think you and I have different ideas of what the word mandates means.
Well, mandate just means it's an order.
No, not every couple must be married. No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that under the Massachusetts State Supreme Court,
they cannot prevent it.
That's exactly correct, and it has to be the word marriage is specifically used. It is not a civil union.
Okay.
And this is one of the reasons why the Vermont law, it causes nobody any problems. And as a matter of fact, if a law similar to the Vermont law were proposed here in California, I would cheerfully support it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that when William James says that whenever you meet a contradiction, make a distinction. The distinction, it seems to me, is pretty obvious in this case. Either people are saying that we have a right to be married because marriage means something different from civil union.
And it evidently does.
But then you're also saying that the state has the right to perform marriages, which is a religious ceremony, as far as I know.
Well, in Massachusetts, that contradiction is being practiced every day, which I find unfortunate. Listen, I've got to get going. My time's up. But I want to thank you, Tom, for calling in and sharing some thoughts with us today.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. It's Tom in Santa Cruz winding up the program today. It's noon here at KSCO, Santa Cruz, KOMY, Watsonville. I'm Charles Friedman, and I'm going to get out of here, make way for Cyril and the Ambassador of the New World Order, and then I'll be back with you between 2 and 3 for Leap to Faith here on KSCO. Enjoy your afternoon, and don't forget to listen to my program, Freedom Challenge, tomorrow at 5 o'clock.
Here, that's all, folks.
KSCO Santa Cruz, KOMY, Watsonville.
Weather watchers keeping an eye on a low-pressure system in the Atlantic off the coast of Florida.
There's a possibility that it may strengthen into a tropical storm, and then wind would be a factor, too.
Weatherbug meteorologist Ryan Tao thinks conditions are coming together for at least a tropical depression with warmer waters and winds, which could be favorable for brewing up a pretty big blow. Too early to get too specific about locations, except to say the east coast of Florida up to the Carolinas could be in the bullseye. Another big storm, this one a full-blown typhoon, blew across an island off the coast of Japan today, injuring at least two. Scores of flights were canceled, along with train and ferry service. More than 70 people are hurting, four on the critical list in Polson, Montana, where a casino balcony collapsed early this morning. Building inspectors, architects, fire, and police officers out there right now inspecting. The balcony was about 10 to 14 feet off the ground when it gave way.
A public apology in the Kobe Bryant case.
And what makes it unusual is that it comes from the judge trying the case.
He has issued a formal apology to the victim's parents for yet the latest gaffe in courtroom procedure, which has exposed private information about their daughter. Wednesday, her name, which is supposed to be sealed, was posted on the court's website. I'm Sarah from Lehman.
And a sports note, ESPN reporting star pitcher Randy Johnson will not leave the Arizona Diamondbacks before today's Major League Baseball trading deadline. This is USA Radio Network News.
Hi, I'm David Orrick, maker of the new Orrick XL Squared Upright Vacuum. It's hotel strong and still weighs only 8 pounds, and Orricks are known to last 25 years. Now, I'm not urging you to buy my new vacuum. I'm urging you to use my new Orrick XL Squared free for 30 days. It won't cost you a dime. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200, and get your home Orrick clean.
Hi, I'm David Orrick. According to the EPA, fresh air is becoming increasingly hard to find, especially in our homes. That's why I want you to try my Orrick Tabletop Air Purifier free for 30 days. It uses the same advanced technology as a U.S. submarine fleet, and it'll clean the air in your home faster than you can say Gesundheit. Call 1-800-989-4200, 1-800-989-4200.
We have now a budget that we can be proud of.
California's governor spent part of his 57th birthday on the road yesterday touting a newly hammered out state budget, which he contends has enough in it to protect the institutions Californians care about most.
Protect the families, protect education, local government, law enforcement, firefighters, nurses, hospitals, and it protects jobs in California.
The spending plan was several weeks late. During that time, you might recall Governor Schwarzenegger deriding his Democratic opponents as girly men. men for sniping at him in the press rather than coming to negotiating sessions. And speaking of Governor Arnold's birthday, in Baghdad, of all places, Iraqis held the country's first post-war bodybuilding competition in his honor. The owner of the Arnold's Classic Gym in Baghdad calls the actor-turned-governor their hero and the greatest champion ever. More than two dozen competitors grunted, flexed, and posed before a panel of judges in the gym's parking lot. USA Radio Network News.
Pet owners, save up to 50% at PetCareRx.com, your pet's online drugstore.
I used to buy heartworm and flea and tick products from my vet. Now I go to PetCareRx online and pay half what I paid the vet.
PetCareRx does it all, from calling my vet to delivering my dog's medicine at incredible savings.
Save up to 50% at PetCareRx.com. That's PetCareRx.com. Or call 1-866-PetCareRx. That's 1-866-PetCareRx. Percent savings may vary by customer, location, and order.
Considering recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission.
While the rest of Congress takes its August recess, the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee got together yesterday to begin hearings on how to implement that September 11th Commission report.
Top members of the 9/11 Commission say the U.S. lacks a sense of urgency in making critical changes in the intelligence gathering and sharing required to prevent terror attacks on America. This is Franklin Brown.
And on Wall Street Friday, stocks closing higher, even though there were some conflicting economic reports, and no matter that oil prices hit another record high Friday. The Dow still added 10 points, ending the last trading session of the month at 10,139. Higher tech NASDAQ gained 6, ending the week at 1887. The broader S&P 500 added just over a point to close at 1101. At the New York Merck, oil futures contracts closed at $43.80 a barrel, the highest ever. There's more news at USARadio.com. Kurt Lewis reporting, USA Radio Network News.
We've got a transmitter, and we're not afraid to use it.
News.